From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Happy New Year. On today's Fresh Air, we look back at the movies and pop records of the 80s. Rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about the performers and the records that made the 80s the decade when rock became controversial again. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff looks at how the values of the Reagan era influenced movies and the movie industry. And TV critic David Bianculli keeps us up to date with the new programs on TV this week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Panamanian President Guillermo Endara said today that General Manuel Noriega does not deserve shelter in the House of God and urged the Vatican to expel him from its embassy in Panama City, an act that would effectively allow the U.S. to take him into custody. Endara said Panama lacked a secure enough prison to hold Noriega on criminal charges, but said he would like to see Noriega tried in Panama after the United States prosecutes the general on drug trafficking charges. A Panamanian man indicted with House to General Noriega arrived in Miami to face drug charges. Jeff White reports.
Daniel Miranda is accused of flying $800,000 in drug money from the United States to Panama in 1983. He was indicted on cocaine trafficking charges by federal authorities in Miami in 1988, along with Manuel Noriega and more than a dozen other Panamanians and Colombians. U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration agents arrested Miranda in Panama on Sunday and brought him to Miami early Monday morning. He's scheduled to appear before a federal magistrate for arraignment on Tuesday. If convicted, Miranda faces up to 5 years in prison and as much as $10,000 in fines. He is the fourth person charged in the 1988 indictment to be brought to the U.S. to stand trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
The White House said today that fewer than 150 American troops are leaving Panama today. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said he hopes all 26,000 troops sent to invade Panama will be home as soon as possible. Israel's unity government is in danger of breaking up over the dismissal of a minister from the moderate Labor Party. Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir charges that Minister Ezer Weitzman violated Israeli law by meeting with officials of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Mark Levy reports.
The Israeli Labor Party is standing firmly behind Ezer Weitzman, threatening to leave the government along with him. Weitzman rejects Labor's official policy, no meetings with the PLO. But Weitzman's dismissal is an inexcusable blow to Labor's dignity. From Shamir's point of view, what Weitzman did was inexcusable. So many agree with Cabinet Minister Yitzhak Modai, the unity government is finished.
I don't see any of the sides that can retreat on its position. It's too delicate. And it's an issue that's delicate not only from the point of view of either party, but from the national point of view, and that's normally the end of the road.
A breakup of the coalition would plunge Israel into a period of political instability. The first casualty would be American efforts to maneuver Israel and the Palestinians into peace negotiations. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Levy in Jerusalem.
Sudan's military government said today it has released 36 political prisoners. The release yesterday coincided with Sudan's 34th independence anniversary, but included no prominent figures. Former Prime Minister Sadek al-Mahdi remains in custody. This is NPR News. The United Mine Workers Union and the Pittston Company have reached agreement on a new contract to end a bitter 9-month strike by about 1,700 coal miners. Details of the pact reached after marathon bargaining that ended late on New Year's Eve were not made public, pending approval by Pittston's board and the union's rank and file. UMW President Richard Trumka said if the miners ratified the deal, they could return to the pits in the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia, West Virginia, and Kentucky by mid-January. A light rain and high winds prompted Philadelphia officials to cancel what is the longest and oldest parade in the nation, the Mummers Parade. Doug Schlatter of member station WHYY in Philadelphia has more.
The parade is a Philadelphia tradition. More than a million spectators line the 2.5-mile route to watch the more than 20,000 mummers strut up Broad Street to City Hall. Many of the mummers wear costumes decked with satins, feathers, and sequins worth thousands of dollars each. This morning, officials decided that the rainy and windy weather could considerably damage those costumes. Sid Kramer is a Mummer official who did not want a repeat of last year when the parade was held in rain and high winds and hundreds of costumes were either damaged or destroyed.
It took 1 year to rebuild all our clubs. We had to start from scratch, and we're not going to be ruined again.
The 12-hour parade has been rescheduled for next Saturday, weather permitting. I'm Doug Schlatter in Philadelphia.
Romania's new government today continued to move away from the barbarous repression of former dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu by abolishing the death penalty. Interim President Ian Iliescu also reestablished the right to own private property, with farmers again permitted to own about an acre of land surrounding their houses. A Panamanian citizen today took over the administration of the Panama Canal for the first time. Fernando Manfredo assumed the top job on a temporary basis. He replaces American D.P. McAuliffe, who is retiring after 10 years. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On the record charts, the 1980s was the decade of Born in the USA and Thriller. For a review of what happened beyond that in pop, Ken Tucker is with us. Ken is Fresh Air's rock critic and a staff writer for the new magazine Entertainment Weekly. Let's start things off with a song from his pick for the best album of the 1980s. So, Ken Tucker, what is this record from the album of the decade that we're listening to?
That's from an album called Get Happy. It was Elvis Costello's fourth album. It was released at the very beginning of the decade, 1980. That song was called I Stand Accused, and at the time, Elvis Costello was accused. I mean, he's phrasing that song as a love song, Girl, I Stand Accused. But one of the reasons that I find this album so fascinating is that, quite aside from its musical merits, which are extraordinary, 20 tracks, all of them, I think, in many ways, really wonderful, varied, beautiful songs that have sort of the high point of Elvis Costello's wordplay, there was something going on in his private life, which was that he had become involved in a drunken brawl while on tour in America with members of Stephen Stills' touring band, including Bonnie Bramlett. And he gave an interview at the time to Greil Marcus after the incident in Rolling Stone magazine, saying that he got very drunk and decided to say something that would infuriate these people that he had contempt for, Stephen Stills, Bonnie Bramlett, and musicians whom he saw as the most decadent sort of American musicians that he and punk rockers in England were reacting against. And he made a racial slur against Ray Charles and James Brown. It was something that he felt deeply ashamed of. Nothing in Elvis Costello's career prior to or subsequent to that would ever lead anyone to think he was a racist. But nevertheless, the publicity that that incident caused just branded him. He said to Greil Marcus, "I'm sure that most people in America know me for this incident and not for my music, and I'm deeply ashamed of that." And he went into the studio 3 months later and recorded Get Happy, saying that what he wanted to do was to make his version of a Motown album. And I think it's just an amazing record. I think that it, in some ways, the Rolling Stone cover line at the time was Elvis Costello repents. And I think this was a great repentance for him.
Does this set the tone for you at all about the decade, having a record reacting against the excesses of certain rock musicians?
I think that's true. I mean, I think that at worst, you can say that the decade is framed by incidents like this, that something like this happens to Elvis Costello. By the end of the decade, 1989, Public Enemy is found members of the group making anti-Semitic remarks and having to call into question their, what I think is, and many other people think is, extraordinarily good music. I think that it's part of the controversy of the decade. I think that this was a decade unlike the 70s, when the music became capable of shock and scandal again, that I think that this music became once again the field on which those kinds of controversies could emerge. And I think that that's really Although we're using bad examples, I think there are very good examples of good music that raised controversies that could not be done in any other field of popular art, that they, except for Spike Lee, were not being raised in the movies, questions of racism and sexism and issues of the Reagan era were being raised in popular music in a way that they weren't in movies, in television, in any other field.
Shall we play your record of the decade, the single of the decade that you've chosen?
Yes. This is George Clinton, and the song is called Atomic Dog.
George Clinton and Atomic Dog, the record Ken has chosen as the single of the year. You know, it's just interesting to me that we're talking about all the issues that have been raised in pop music in the 80s, and your single of the year is really like a novelty tune in a lot of ways.
It is in a way, but it's also a tremendously influential piece of music. I mean, it sounds like there's this cat and dog jokiness, which is very typical of George Clinton, but at the same time, that riff that was heard in songs all throughout the decade. That song came out at the beginning of the decade. It was just enormously influential, and it carries on through. I'm glad I have the opportunity to explain this to your listeners. That is where Arsenio Hall's audience gets their woof woof chant that they chant at the beginning of Arsenio Hall's show. I think it's very funny. I was just reading New Republic. There was a letter correcting someone saying, those Arsenio Hall audience members are saying the words roof, roof. And the New York Times had some other idea about where it came from. That's where it comes from. It comes from George Clinton. And Clinton is just both as a solo artist and with his groups Parliament and Funkadelic, I think, an artist who never got kind of mainstream recognition in mainstream press, but it was just enormously influential. I mean, he's seen as a kind of godfather of rap music, for example, now.
You have an example of how that works.
That's right. Well, one of the ways that Clinton records is that he recorded this group, Funkadelic. There was a song called Not Just Knee Deep, and that song, years later, was used by the group De La Soul in 1989 for their song Me, Myself, and I. I think if we played a little bit from Not Just Knee Deep, we could hear that.
Just to explain here, what a lot of the rappers have done in the 80s is do their raps over the rhythm tracks of other people's records. And this Funkadelic record is an example of a rhythm track that was used for a later rap by the group De La Soul.
Exactly.
So we'll start with Funkadelic?
Mm-hmm. So that's Not Just Knee Deep, recorded in the mid-80s. And then De La Soul, the way many rap groups do, took that riff that they really liked and admired and used it for their purposes in their 1989 song, Me, Myself, and I.
It's just me, myself, and I.
I mean, I think you can hear that. I mean, that's as close as it comes to plagiarism, I suppose, in some sort of technical sense. And that's one of the controversies of the decade, whether rappers doing this were expressing a kind of creativity or whether they were just stealing. In that particular case, De La Soul was taking that Not Just Knee Deep riff from George Clinton, adding, scratching their own vocals, their own lyrical ideas, and Clinton thought it was great. I mean, he went on record as saying that he thinks that's wonderful. In the exact same track, there was a tiny, tiny, maybe 1 or 2 seconds long, snippet from a Turtles song. And the Turtles, those aging 60s vets who don't seem to know what's going on, took great umbrage at this and have a lawsuit against De La Soul, which has yet to be settled. They claim that it was pure plagiarism of their music.
Are there any precedents now about whether using a rhythm track for a rap record is plagiarizing?
It's really up in the air. There are legal cases that are pending in a number of different records, but nothing's really come down one way or the other. There may be precedents in terms of, say, Bette Midler's recent suit about a sound-alike appearing on a commercial. She won that lawsuit, and so that may have some effect on that. But the legal issues are very hazy, and I think that it's interesting that that kind of artistic expression, which I think you can see back in kind of modernist art of collage, is being used in that kind of legal area now.
My guest is Ken Tucker. He's the rock critic for Fresh Air and now writes for the new magazine, Entertainment Weekly. And what we're doing is talking about some of the issues that emerged in the 80s in rock music, and Ken's playing some of the what he considers to be the best music of the decade. And we'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Rock critic Ken Tucker is my guest, and we're talking about rock music of the 1980s. We were just talking about rap records. How do you think rap has changed in the 1980s? It really started, I mean, the first rap records were in the very late 70s. It was really in the 80s that it took off commercially.
Well, I think that just in terms of technology, the production has gotten a lot better. Those kinds of transitions are made much more smoothly between the way bits and pieces of songs are taken and woven together in the course of a song. I also think that the subject matter is broadened considerably, that initially at the beginning of the decade, things were just, a lot of rap music was about celebrating of the self. A lot of raps were about, gee, I'm amazed I'm in a recording studio kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of rap music as the decade went on took on lots of social issues, took on a lot of subjects, very sort of straightforward, ordinary life situations about being in school and dealing with your parents and that kind of thing. So I think that the subject matter ranged a lot more widely as the decade went on.
You were saying before that you think this has been an interesting decade in the sense that some of the predominant artists, some of the most interesting artists, have been blacks and women.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it was a real nose-thumbing to the idea that rock and roll is a white male establishment. I think that someone like Madonna and Prince showed themselves to be endlessly inventive musicians and were, when they first emerged at the beginning of the decade, artists that people thought really weren't going to have much of a career at all. I think that a record like Madonna's Like a Virgin was a really wonderful, bracing shock to popular music at the time. I mean, I think it's a wonderful track as music. I think that it completely negated the criticism of Madonna that she couldn't sing, that she wasn't a musician, that kind of thing, in addition to raising such a storm of controversy, which she continued by the end of the decade with another song, Like a Prayer. It's like a virgin, like a prayer. She's sort of the mistress of the simile in the decade. But, I mean, I think Like a Virgin really holds up as a solid record.
Why don't we give it a listen?
Sure.
Madonna's hit, Like a Virgin. You also mentioned Prince as being one of the outstanding figures.
That's right.
In the 80s. Interesting, too. One thing he has in comparison with Madonna is that they both sing a lot about sex.
That's right. Yeah, and Prince managed to sustain that. I mean, everybody thought, oh, he released an album in 1980 called Dirty Mind, and which I thought was just a wonderful album. And everybody thought, well, you know, once he gets through with this sex theme, you know, this guy's going to go nowhere. You know, he's a novelty act. But that certainly hasn't proven to be true either. He's continued throughout the decade to make, I mean, very uneven, very ambitious. I mean, he's certainly had his share of dreadful records and bad movies that he's made. But I think that something like Dirty Mind, when I hear it now, it's almost inconceivable for that record to be released, in a sense, that given the current climate with the Parents Music Resource Center attacking records with explicit sexual content, that a track on Dirty Mind, like this one that we're going to play called Sister, that deals with incest, I mean, it's amazing that in the current climate this record could have been released back then, I think. Boy, is it getting hot in here or what?
Is this record an example of what you were talking about before, you know, about how rock was taking on issues that were very controversial and suddenly people were getting upset and angry about the danger and the power of rock music again?
Yeah, well, I think when that record came out, it was such a total surprise because things like that just weren't appearing at the time, I don't think, very much. And there was certainly nothing organized like the PMRC to sort of come out and issue a formal statement, whereas in 1989 you have things like the PMRC, you have really extraordinary moves like this past year. The rap group NWA came under attack by nothing less than the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which released a letter that was distributed to record retailers saying that they disapproved of one particular cut on an NWA rap album that was about shooting policemen. I mean, I think when you have government or semi-government bodies taking positions on music, I mean, that's something that in 1980 I don't think anyone could have anticipated.
And you think that's good?
I think good?
No, no.
I think it's awful.
What I meant was you think that it's good that the music
has
much teeth that it's arousing that kind of sentiment. I didn't mean to imply that you thought that potential censorship was...
Go FBI. Boy, I could give you a list. No, I think it's wonderful. I think that especially when you contrast the fact that... But I don't know if you remember the end of the 70s, Terry, but people were saying, oh, boy, the music's really done for. This disco stuff, it's ruined. This rap stuff, it's just noise and that kind of thing. And everybody was saying what a dull decade the 70s was. Well, I mean, I don't really believe that, but I think that if anything, the music got a lot livelier and got a lot more combative and did get a lot feistier over the course of this decade, which makes the music all the more interesting.
What were the biggest records of the 80s, and how do they hold up?
Well, I think you have something like, certainly Thriller was the best-selling. Michael Jackson's record Thriller was the best-selling album of the decade. Billboard magazine just published a decade-end issue that said that Thriller was the number one album for 2 years, which was unprecedented for 83 and 84. I think it's a absolutely amazing feat of record-making. It's a wonderful album, but you could not get me to listen to Thriller if you held a gun to my head at this point. I just think it's an album that was so overplayed that was just the repetition of it just ruined it in a way. I think that was also true of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. I think when you have records like this, that's one thing that certainly came across, I think, in this decade, when a record becomes so pervasive that other forms of media do seize on it, that it gets used in commercials, in politics, as Born in the USA was during one of the presidential campaigns in this decade. Things get just played into the ground, and the music gets ruined in some very fundamental way, that even though if you took these records to someone who had never heard them before, they could probably appreciate them, but I think it's almost impossible to have to come to them with a clear mind now.
Are there records that you thought were really good at the time that, looking back, don't really hold up that well?
Yeah, I was trying to sort of come up with a list of things that I thought were the best albums and singles of the decade, and there were things that I thought would certainly be on that list and then realized hadn't held up. I'm thinking specifically of David Byrne and Talking Heads, anything by Sting or The Police. I tried to put some of those records on, and I thought, you know, I've heard this. It's received from other things. It's you know, there are other sources of that music that are much more interesting than that music itself. I thought that was also true of the Irish group U2, which I've campaigned against over the course of this decade as being one of the most overrated acts I can imagine. And even something like Paul Simon's Graceland, which I do not discredit as a good record of itself, but received such media hype and such overkill that I think it ended up being overesteemed by many people. I think that in some ways Paul Simon's Graceland made people aware of world music and that's that sort of mini trend at the end of the decade. But it was not the second coming that it was publicized as being.
Well, since you brought up world music in that comment, let me ask you, I get the impression you're one of the holdouts on world music, that you're a little resistant to it.
I am, only in the sense that I guess this is a certain conservatism on my part. I'm not quite sure. I mean, the reason I love popular music is, one of the reasons is that I can understand the words, I can understand the cultural context from which it comes. Now, by understand the words, I don't mean I can make out the lyrics the way people complain that you can't understand the words. But I think that that sort of wholesale usurping of other cultures, while the music is interesting, it doesn't, for me, deliver the whole experience of what pop music can be. I can admire musicians from other countries, but I don't completely understand the cultural context. I don't claim to the way I think many people do who promote that music. And for me, I mean, I don't know. I feel awful even sort of saying it, because I think that it sounds sort of jingoistic or something. But I do think that the idea is to understand pop music both from what's being said in the music and the music itself.
Shall we end this by making note of some of the people who died in the 80s?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the two biggest losses that I can think of were Roy Orbison and especially Marvin Gaye. I think that Marvin Gaye's death was especially tragic in that he had just released one of the strongest albums he'd ever made, and he was making a comeback. He had a wonderful number one hit single, Sexual Healing, which was a song that, as I think about it, at the end of the decade would have given the PMRC the willies. And he's someone who could have stood up to the PMRC. I would have loved to have seen dapper, eloquent Marvin Gaye dealing with Tipper Gore and her crew. And I think that it's one of the greatest losses.
Well, Ken, thanks a lot for talking with us about music of the past decade of the 1980s.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ken Tucker is rock critic for Fresh Air and also writes now for the new magazine Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and let's close out with Marvin Gaye.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Happy New Year. We're listening to music from David Cronenberg's film, The Fly. It's one of the movies that made it onto Stephen Schiff's list of the best movies of the decade. Coming up, film critic Stephen Schiff reads us the rest of that list and explains some of the behind-the-scenes deal-making that determined what we saw at the movies in the 80s. Also, TV critic David Bianculli keeps us up to date with the first television week of the 1990s. He says some of the new shows seem all too familiar. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. The first U.S. combat troops are heading back to the United States today after leaving Panama. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says about 140 soldiers from Fort Ord, California, are headed back. Fitzwater says the president is glad to see some of the troops coming home and hopes the rest can leave as soon as possible. The Panamanian government has now reversed itself in its decision on whether General Manuel Noriega should be tried on criminal charges inside his own country. NPR's John Burnett reports.
President Guillermo Endara said today that he would like to see Manuel Noriega tried for murder inside Panama, but only after Noriega is brought to trial in the United States, where he's charged with drug trafficking in two Florida courts. This would still give Panama time to consolidate its new justice system, which is less than 2 weeks old. Yesterday, Endara said his country's courts were in the early stages of reorganization. He said Panama has no viable Supreme Court, nor could it guarantee due process. Panamanian officials believe that justice and punishment would be more impartial in a U.S. court at this point. Presumably, the president changed his mind after his comments grated on Panamanian sense of nationalism. Panama's new attorney general, Dr. Rogelio Cruz, said Noriega would be charged probably tomorrow with 10 counts of murder for the execution of officers who tried to overthrow him in the failed October 3rd coup. In Panama City, this is John Burnett reporting.
Negotiators for the Pittston Coal Group and the United Mine Workers have reached a tentative agreement to end a bitter 9-month strike. At the center of the dispute was the company's refusal to pay into a health and pension fund. Susan Leffler reports on today's announcement.
Both sides refused to disclose the contents of the settlement, saying they were obligated to explain the document first to the union rank and file. But Secretary of Labor Elizabeth Dole, who took a personal interest in ending the dispute, described the agreement as a winning one for everyone.
And today's settlement is a very special holiday gift for all parties involved, a gift for the Pittston Company, which can now move forward and work toward a productive future and a supportive work environment. And a gift for the workers, their families, and their communities who have faced 9 months of a bitter labor dispute.
Dole said that in addition to resolving the current dispute over benefits, a Blue Ribbon Commission would be set up to determine a long-term solution to the problem of providing worker health and pension funds. For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Leffler.
With police standing guard outside, about 200 people attended an NAACP church program and offered prayer in the face of threats of against the heels of a recent series of mail bombs. The New Year's Day program in a Southwest Atlanta church began after a search by agents. No bombs were found. The annual NAACP program commemorating the Emancipation Proclamation was one of several held across the nation. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. We paid more and more for movie tickets in the 1980s, but one increase I was happy about was more freshly popped popcorn at theaters. Here to talk about what we actually saw on the screen is Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff. He brought his list of the decade's best films, but first let's consider the trends that influenced movie making in the 80s.
There was a period that I called the supply-side movies period, in which I think there were a lot of movies that had the traditional Hollywood liberal tone about them, but really were infected by Reaganism, by which I mean movies like Trading Places and Arthur. These are big hit movies in which the little people are celebrated, being at the bottom and still being an okay person is a principle that is celebrated. All this is celebrated as long as you wind up in the end filthy rich. And that, I think, was very characteristic of the Reagan era. That, in 83, after a decade of having a severe recession in this country. We had an economic turnaround, and the joy with which the people in the movie business received that economic turnaround was hard to erase from the movies they were making. And so the happy ending was always just buckets of money being poured down people's gullets. That reflected a kind of strain in the culture that was going on between two impulses, the impulse to be nice to people and the impulse to be very, very nice to oneself.
I found myself this decade seeing a lot of movies I liked, but on the other hand, always bracing myself to be really let down. And I know that there's been weekend after weekend during certain slumps where there was just virtually nothing that was really worth seeing. I'd go anyways.
Yeah.
But I'd be let down. Did you find this was often the decade of being let down at the movies?
Well, I felt the middle years of the 80s were ghastly years. And what happened in the 80s is that movie making and marketing became very, very sophisticated. It began to rely more and more on things like surveys and test screenings and people juggling with plots, endings, stars, titles, everything else in order to respond to marketing surveys and that sort of thing. And as that happened, movies became less and less interesting. And about the middle of the decade, when people really had the demographics of the movie audience down to a science, which is to say, why make a movie for anyone older than 24 years old or younger than 18, and with less income than this, and with more education than this, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When that happened, you really had just product being pumped out, and the product was bad because it was. I mean, movies have always been this weird combination of commerce and art, and when it becomes too much commerce, the art goes out of it, and suddenly when that happens, the commerce drops out because people just don't want to see these things, you, me, or anyone else.
So you say this was at its worst in the mid-80s. Do you feel like we're out of that now?
I do feel like I'm... 89 for me was a very nice year at the movies, and 88 was pretty good, too. I think that the formulas... As I say, there became a moment of diminishing returns. The formulas began to create very bad movies, and when the bad movies started coming out, the formulas no longer worked anymore because no one wants to see bad movies, even if those bad movies are demographically geared to them. A lot of stuff like that is happening now at the end of the decade because people know that finally what makes a good movie is talented movie makers, not prescient marketing surveys.
Well, let's look at some of the trends that affected which movies got made in the 80s. The 80s was an era in which most of the big studios got bought up by other companies, and basically the movies were run by the conglomerates. Do you think that kind of conglomerate-run movie industry has changed the way deals are made and has changed which movies get made?
Well, I think that was what was going on in the mid-80s for a while. I do think that the idea that a movie was a product and that you could market it the way you market Coca-Cola was very much in the spirit of the 80s. And it turned out to be a little bit true and a lot untrue. And that will never disappear, especially as long as there are conglomerates running the movie business. But one has to also keep in mind that the conglomerates now are largely huge entertainment conglomerates. It's not like the days when Transamerica was running movie companies. Time will tell what Sony does to Columbia and TriStar. But the people running Fox are entertainment people. The people running Paramount are largely entertainment people. The people running Disney are entertainment people. These people have come through the industry through TV, and they have a feeling not for art, but they at least have a feeling for what goes into, say, telling a story, hiring stars, presenting them to the public. I see that as a somewhat hopeful sign, maybe not a completely hopeful sign, because these people are still nothing like artists, I don't think you're ever going to see an efflorescence like the kind you saw in the early 70s when suddenly Hollywood was taken over not by an economic theory but by an artistic theory, that theory being auteurism, and people like Francis Coppola and Martin Scorsese and Brian De Palma and other real directors, real artists, were kind of given their head and were allowed to make the movies they wanted to make. And I think it'll be a very long time before we have an era like that again.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Fresh Air's film critic, Stephen Schiff, and we're talking about films in the 1980s. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Film critic Stephen Schiff is my guest. Stephen, I think the 1980s was an interesting decade for England when we saw a lot of small films about outsiders produced on pretty low budgets. And I'm thinking of Mona Lisa, My Beautiful Laundrette, Prick Up Your Ears, Comfort and Joy if we expand England into Britain.
And
this year saw Christy Brown.
Yeah, My Left Foot, absolutely
right. My Left Foot, I mean, sorry, thank
you. Yeah, absolutely right. I think England really triumphed, and it was a triumph of a kind of system because almost all those movies came out of their Channel 4. In other words, these were movies made with TV money, subsidized movies made very cheaply and very, very well by people who, I mean, Stephen Frears is kind of a hot commodity now, but he had been making movies for Channel 4 for years and years and years. Your list could go on and on. High Hopes was one of my favorite movies of 89, and that was a movie made by Mike Leigh, who'd been kind of toiling in the vineyards of Channel 4 for years and years and years, for at least the previous decade. And these artists working very, very well within that system with a small budget, but with a constant sort of secure source of money, that should be an example to a lot of film industries.
There have been periods during the 80s where you'd go to the movies and felt that you were watching a deal instead of a film.
Yeah.
How did deal-making change in the 80s?
The one important thing that really happened in the 80s was that the movie stars themselves became production companies, and that gave them even more and more inordinate power. You know, people are always trying to figure out how to make this game a sure thing, and of course it will never be a sure thing. But when they hit upon something like a star who seems to attract people to the movie theater, that becomes as close to a sure thing as they have. There are very, very few stars of that sort now, and they're only stars of that sort until they have a flop. It looked like Michael J. Fox was a star of that sort, and then Casualties of War was a flop. It looked like, and Clint Eastwood was a star of that sort for longer than anyone in history, but his last movie, Pink Cadillac, was a flop. Eddie Murphy looks like a star of that sort now, but you know, I think his time is due. Tom Cruise proved himself a star of that sort when he made Cocktail, a wretched movie by anyone's standards that still made $70 million. So in terms of making the deal, the star became very, very important, and stars began being able to influence the content of the movie in a way that was never before possible, and to generate movies and to write their own tickets. And now virtually every star of any size has his own production company, which makes deal-making very much more complicated. At the same time, what that did was it put a lot of power on the side of the agents, because the agents handled the stars, and then the directors who had become stars in the 70s were also handled by agents. And pretty soon it became possible for agents to say, well, I've got this star director, and I've got this star, and I'm going to put them together, and you, the studio, can take it or leave it. So that became this famous thing called packaging, and it led to, it used to be that a studio head was the most powerful man in Hollywood. By general agreement, the most powerful man in Hollywood now is Michael Ovitz, the head of the largest agency, CAA.
What about the way movies are sometimes pre-sold? The rights to movies are sometimes pre-sold.
Well, this movement, which had been going on for a long time, hit its height in the 80s with the video boom and the general spread of cable and a kind of burgeoning international market. It became possible for all these markets combined are called the ancillary markets, and it became possible for people to make movies that would play very poorly in American theaters just on the basis of pre-sales to these ancillary markets. The people who were best at this were these crazy guys, Golan and Globus, who ran this company called Canon. And what they would do is they would scratch an idea on a napkin. Let's say they said, E.T. only tall. Okay, and that was their idea. And then they said, who could we get who's tall? Who's tall? Clint Eastwood has E.T. Okay, great. And then they would take the idea to Canon, and they wouldn't talk to anyone who owned E.T., and they wouldn't talk to anyone, and they wouldn't talk to Clint Eastwood. Be advised, this is a very hypothetical example. But they would go to Canon, and they would meet with representatives from the film market in, say, Senegal, and in Japan, and in Chile. And pretty soon, these people would be saying, yeah, that sounds like a good movie, and I'll put some money into it, and I'll play it in my theater. And pretty soon, they'd have enough money to actually go back to us to Clint Eastwood, say, or the makers of E.T., and say, look, I've got all this money committed. Why don't we make the movie? A lot of really bad movies happened that way.
Name one.
There were lots of movies. Well, the most amazing project was Jean-Luc Godard's King Lear, which did wind up being a very bad movie, although not as bad as it might have been if it had gone by its original plan, which was to star Norman Mailer as King Lear. It was a mad project, and it ended up doing no one any good. But that was the kind of project that resulted. And the other thing that resulted was a slew of just unspeakable little horror movies that never would have played in a theater near you, but they had to in order to get the right video deal. In other words, they had to get one review. Someone saying, scared the pants off me, then they sell it on that basis to a video company, and it goes straight to your video store.
Now, is this pre-sale of international rights still operating at the same level it was in the mid-'80s?
Maybe not as insane and maybe not as open, but yes, it's definitely still operating at a very high level.
There was a period in the first part of the 1980s that was like the Porky's scare. Every movie seemed to be a teen movie that was loosely based on Porky's. How did we get out of that? It seems that the movie industry isn't as teen-driven as it was in the first part of the decade.
No, that's absolutely right. That was a result of the sophistication of marketing surveys. People realized that it was sort of, yes, grown-ups go to the movies, and you know, 40-year-old and 50-year-old people go to the movies, but not very many of them compared with the number of teenagers who go to the movies. So why bother making a film for a tiny market when you can make a film for a large market, and it can be dumb? You know, you don't have to have high-priced talent. You don't have to have stars. You don't have to work very hard on it. You can make it fast. You can make it cheap. It can look no better than TV, and it'll be as big a hit as Porky's. And later on, there became these sort of maestros of that kind of filmmaking. I'm thinking of John Hughes, you know, who almost raised it to an art form, although it was not an art form that I appreciated very much. I mean, Ferris Bueller's Day Off was one of the top 10 grocers in more ways than one of its year. And that was scary for a lot of us out there. And we spent, you know, 5 or 6 years watching the teen movies trundle in and trundle out. And then they stopped attracting kids. They pandered a great deal. They were very repetitive. There was this peak year where Back to School and Ferris Bueller's Day Off were both in the top 10. And that was, you know, that was a very ugly year for a lot of us. And then even the teens seemed to get tired of them. I mean, every movie would begin in high school, and the rivalries were always the same. And with each new attempt, the sort of psychological penetration would seem less and less. And there was a backlash. And I think it's sort of a sad thing. One of my favorite movies of 1989 is a movie called Say Anything, which is a teen romance. And I think it's better than The Graduate and has a kind of similar structure. It was dismissed out of hand as yet another teen romance. It's not yet another teen romance. It's a very good movie. Another movie at the beginning of the year called Heathers, which I thought was very provocative and interesting, covering the same ground, was a fresh take on it and was not ignored, but I think given a different background, would have gotten a more serious kind of attention.
This is really the first decade that home video has had a really big effect on how people see movies, when they see movies. Do you think that home video has affected either which movies get produced theatrically or the aesthetics by which they're produced? Do you think that film directors are thinking ahead to how the movies are going to play when they're shrunk down to home video?
Well, you know, when at the beginning of this home video era, we all thought that would something like that would happen. We thought, what's it going to mean when you want to see a movie 10 times, when you own the movie? What's that going to mean for film aesthetics? Mostly, though, the video revolution turned into rentals. I think the way home video really influenced movie making was as an ancillary market, as a place where you could pre-sell the movie, where you could know that you were going to make money, even if the movie was bad, even if the movie didn't do well in theaters. And largely the effect was it created a lot more product. There's a lot of bad movie making out there that will find its way directly to video without ever passing by your eyes or mine.
Well, I think it's time, Stephen, to read your list of the top films of the 1980s.
Well, what a pleasure that will be.
Drum roll, please.
Yeah. Now, you know, it's a long decade, and I couldn't do 10, so I did 15.
Well, we'll let you get away with it this time.
Thank you so much. And now, these are in alphabetical order, but I do have a favorite. So I'll take that one out of alphabetical order and save it for last.
Okay.
Okay. Otherwise, in alphabetical order, the top 15, A Nos Amours by Maurice Pialat, Atlantic City, Louis Malle, Blowout, Brian De Palma, Blue Velvet, David Lynch, Diner, Barry Levinson, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Steven Spielberg, Melvin and Howard, Jonathan Demme, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life by Terry Jones and everybody else, Pichote by Hector Bibenco, Pritzi's Honor, John Huston, Shoot the Moon, Alan Parker, The Fly, David Cronenberg, Tootsie, Sidney Pollack, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, Pedro Almodovar, and my favorite movie of the 80s, The Night of the Shooting Stars by the Taviani Brothers.
Now, what do these movies, your choices for the best films of the 1980s, what do they have to say about the trends and patterns that you've been discussing? Do they relate to them at all?
Well, I think it's characteristic of a great movie to be either the culmination of a trend so much so that it supersedes all trends, or to be way outside the loop.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these, I think, are outside the loop. The trends of the 80s were so deadening on the whole, were so formulaic, were so kind of corporate driven instead of artistically driven, that these movies sort of had to escape that kind of trend area. I think that gives them a sort of power. They're fresh, they're alive, they're new, they're different. They turned a lot of heads, including mine.
Well, Stephen Schiff, I wish you a very happy new year.
Well, the same to you, Terry.
And thanks for talking with us about movies of the 80s. Thank
Great
you.
Pleasure.
Stephen Schiff is film critic for Fresh Air and critic at large for Vanity Fair.
She
This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today on All Things Considered, we're going to have the first report from my co-host, Noah Adams, from Romania. And we'll also hear from Andrei Codrescu, who is also traveling in Eastern Europe, a report on a synagogue in Budapest. We'll be following the stories in Panama, of course, and we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about this new year. Verda Mae Grosvenor brought in some black-eyed peas to tell us about what you ought to eat for good luck on New Year's Day. And we'll have the tabloid Tatler on pulp predictions for the 90s. That's on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Television critic David Bianculli says if you look at the programs premiering this week on TV, what's new in the 1990s is really old hat.
Well, it's the first week of the new year for TV, and it's time to check out what's new in TV land. Here's something, the premiere of an ABC drama series. Tracy Nelson plays a nun who has some very unusual ways of teaching math to her wayward students.
Okay, we're going to do fractions now. Down on a horse going off at 3-2. You've bet $1. How much do you win?
More than I had before.
Yeah, but how much?
$1.50.
That's great.
I know it sounds familiar, kind of a to sister with love. But it gets even more familiar once we meet her parish priest.
Look, I have this nasty habit of looking for odd details in people's behavior, and almost everyone has some incongruities.
That's Tom Bosley, who played the father on Happy Days, and more recently, the father on The Father Dowling Mysteries, that stupid NBC series that was canceled last season. This new ABC show is also called The Father Dowling Mysteries, and it's nothing but new episodes of that same stupid series, shown on a different network. Okay, let's move on. The Family Channel, a basic cable network, is also launching a new series this week. It's about a swashbuckling hero who wears a black cape and a mask and carries a whip and a sword. Here's a part of the show's theme song.
When daggers are pointed at innocent hearts and muskets are ready to fire, where tyrants ride high and govern with fear as the forces of evil conspire, then from out of the night a hero must rise with courage that even a mask won't disguise. They turn to the man called Zorro.
Yep, that's right. Duncan Regaer plays Zorro in these new adventures, which compare pretty favorably, except for the theme song, to the old Disney series from the 50s that I watched when I was a kid. New World Television, which produces this new Zorro series, has updated the characters, though, and taken its cue from last year's Batman movie. Zorro's mute sidekick is now a young kid, more like a Robin the Boy Wonder than an Alfred the Butler. And this new Zorro has forensic detective skills that place him on a par with Batman or Sherlock Holmes. Still, it's hard to look at a remake of a 35-year-old TV series and think of it as progress. But wait, Arts and Entertainment has a new 2-hour movie premiering this week. It's about a doctor who is wrongly convicted of the murder of his wife but escapes before being sent to prison. Years later, with the cops on his tail, he finally finds and confronts the one-armed man who... No, wait a minute. This A&E premiere is nothing but a repackaged repeat of the 2-part conclusion of The Fugitive, which was shown 22 years ago. This is ridiculous. Surely there has to be something new that's really new to kick off the 90s. And there is. This Friday, NBC presents the premiere of a new cop show that hasn't been canceled by another network, isn't a remake, and isn't a repeat. It's called Max Monroe, Loose Cannon. And it stars Shadow Stevens, whose biggest showbiz credit is as a Hollywood square. Is it too early to get nostalgic for the good old 1980s?
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon is our director. I'm Terry Gross, and we wish you a Happy New Year.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet composer John Adams. He wrote the score for the opera Nixon in China. Also, Stefan Canford tells us why the Borscht Belt turned out so many comics. He's the author of A History of the Catskill Mountains and its famous resort hotels. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.